The funeral ceremony for Jameis was beginning. She looked out at the Arakene sunset, at the banked decks of color in the sky. Night was beginning to utter its shadows along the distant rocks and the dunes, yet the heat persisted. Heat forced her thoughts onto water, and the observed fact that this whole people could be trained to be thirsty only at given times. Thirst. She could remember moonlit waves on Caladan throwing white robes over rocks, and the wind heavy with dampness. Now the breeze that fingered her robes seared the patches of exposed skin at cheeks and forehead. The new nose plugs irritated her, and she found herself overly conscious of the tube that trailed down across her face into the suit, recovering her breath's moisture. The suit itself was a sweat box.
"Your suit will be more comfortable when you've adjusted to a lower water content in your body," Stilgar had said.
She knew he was right, but the knowledge made this moment no more comfortable. The unconscious preoccupation with water here weighed on her mind. No, she corrected herself, it was preoccupation with moisture. And that was a more subtle and profound matter. She heard approaching footsteps, turned to see Paul come out of the cave's depths trailed by the elfin-faced Chani. There's another thing, Jessica thought. Paul must be cautioned about their women. One of these desert women would not do as wife to a duke. As concubine, yes, but not as wife. Then she wondered at herself, thinking, have I been infected with his schemes? And she saw how well she had been conditioned. I can think of the marital needs of royalty without once weighing my own concubinage. Yet I was more than concubine.
Mother.
Paul stopped in front of her. Chani stood at his elbow.
Mother, do you know what they're doing back there?
Jessica looked at the dark patch of his eyes staring out from the hood.
I think so.
Chani showed me, because I'm supposed to see it and give my permission for the weighing of the water. Jessica looked at Chani.
They're recovering Jameis's water, Chani said, and her thin voice came out nasal past the nose plugs. It's the rule. The flesh belongs to the person, but his water belongs to the tribe, except in the combat.
They say the water's mine, Paul said.
Jessica wondered why this should make her suddenly alert and cautious.
Combat water belongs to the winner, Chani said. It's because you have to fight in the open without stillsuits. The winner has to get his water back that he loses while fighting.
I don't want his water, Paul muttered.
He felt that he was a part of many images moving simultaneously in a fragmenting way that was disconcerting to the inner eye. He could not be certain what he would do, but of one thing he was positive. He did not want the water distilled out of Jameis's flesh.
It's water, Chani said.
Jessica marveled at the way she said it.
Water.
So much meaning in a simple sound. A Bene Gesserit axiom came to Jessica's mind.
Survival is the ability to swim in strange water.
And Jessica thought,
Paul and I, we must find the currents and patterns in these strange waters, if we're to survive. You will accept the water, Jessica said.
She recognized the tone in her voice. She had used that same tone once with Leto, telling her lost duke that he would accept a large sum offered for his support in a questionable venture, because money maintained power for the Atreides. On Arrakis, water was money. She saw that clearly. Paul remained silent, knowing then that he would do as she ordered, not because she ordered it, but because her tone of voice had forced him to reevaluate. To refuse the water would be to break with accepted Fremen practice. Presently, Paul recalled the words of 467 Kalama in Yui's OC Bible. He said, "From water does all life begin." Jessica stared at him.
"Where did he learn that quotation?" she asked herself. "He hasn't studied the mysteries." "Thus it is spoken," Chani said. "Giyu de Charmantin, it is written in the Shahnama that water was the first of all things created."
For no reason she could explain, and this bothered her more than the sensation, Jessica suddenly shuddered. She turned away to hide her confusion, and was just in time to see the sunset. A violent calamity of color spilled over the sky as the sun dipped beneath the horizon.
"It is time!"
The voice was Stilgar's ringing in the cavern.
"Jameis's weapon has been killed. Jameis has been called by him, by Shai-Hulud, who has ordained the phases for the moons that daily wane and, in the end, appear as bent and withered twigs."
Stilgar's voice lowered.
"Thus it is with Jameis."
Silence fell like a blanket on the cavern. Jessica saw the gray shadow movement of Stilgar like a ghost figure within the dark inner reaches.
She glanced back at the basin, sensing the coolness.
"The friends of Jameis will approach," Stilgar said.
Men moved behind Jessica, dropping a curtain across the opening. A single glow globe was lighted overhead, far back in the cave. Its yellow glow picked out an inflowing of human figures. Jessica heard the rustling of the robes. Chani took a step away, as though pulled by the light. Jessica bent close to Paul's ear, speaking in the family code.
"Follow their lead. Do as they do. It will be a simple ceremony to placate the shade of Jameis."
It will be more than that, Paul thought, and he felt a wrenching sensation within his awareness, as though he were trying to grasp something in motion and render it motionless. Chani glided back to Jessica's side, took her hand.
"Come, Sayadina, we must sit apart."
Paul watched them move off into the shadows, leaving him alone. He felt abandoned. The men who had fixed the curtain came up beside him.
"Come, Usul."
He allowed himself to be guided forward, to be pushed into a circle of people being formed around Stilgar, who stood beneath the glow globe and beside a bundled, curving, and angular shape gathered beneath a robe on the rock floor. The troop crouched down at a gesture from Stilgar, their robes hissing with the movement. Paul settled with them, watching Stilgar, noting the way the overhead globe made pits of his eyes and brightened the touch of green fabric at his neck. Paul shifted his attention to the robe-covered mound at Stilgar's feet, recognized the handle of a balisset protruding from the fabric.
"The spirit leaves the body's water when the first moon rises," Stilgar intoned. "Thus it is spoken. When we see the first moon rise this night, whom will it summon?"
"Jameis,"
the troop responded. Stilgar turned full circle on one heel, passing his gaze across the ring of faces.
"I was a friend of Jameis," he said. "When the hawk plane stooped upon us at Hole in the Rock, it was Jameis pulled me to safety."
He bent over the pile beside him, lifted away the robe.
"I take this robe as a friend of Jameis. Leader's right."
He draped the robe over a shoulder, straightening. Now Paul saw the contents of the mound exposed, the pale, glistening gray of a stillsuit, a battered leader john, a kerchief with a small book in its center, the bladeless handle of a kris knife, an empty sheath, a folded pack, a paracompass, a distrans, a thumper, a pile of fist-sized metallic hooks, an assortment of what looked like small rocks within a fold of cloth, a clump of bundled feathers, and the balisset exposed beside the folded pack.
"So Jameis played the balisset," Paul thought.
The instrument reminded him of Gurney Halleck and all that was lost. Paul knew, with his memory of the future and the past, that some chance lines could produce a meeting with Halleck, but the reunions were few and shadowed. They puzzled him. The uncertainty factor touched him with wonder.
"Does it mean that something I will do, that I may do, could destroy Gurney? Or bring him back to life? Or..."
Paul swallowed, shook his head. Again, Stilgar bent over the mound.
"For Jameis's woman and for the guards," he said.
The small rocks and the book were taken into the folds of his robe.
"Leader's right," the troop intoned. "The marker for Jameis's coffee service," Stilgar said,
and he lifted a flat disc of green metal.
"That it shall be given to Usul in suitable ceremony when we return to the siege."
"Leader's right," the troop intoned.
Lastly, he took the kris knife handle and stood with it.
"For the funeral plane," he said. "For the funeral plane," the troop responded.
At her place in the circle across from Paul, Jessica nodded, recognizing the ancient source of the rite, and she thought,
"The meeting between ignorance and knowledge, between brutality and culture. It begins in the dignity with which we treat our dead."
She looked across at Paul, wondering,
"Will he see it? Will he know what to do?"
"We are friends of Jameis," Stilgar said. "We are not wailing for our dead like a pack of Gardvarg."
A gray-bearded man to Paul's left stood up.
"I was a friend of Jameis," he said.
He crossed to the mound, lifted the distrans.
"When our water went below minimum at the siege at Two Birds, Jameis shared."
The man returned to his place in the circle.
"Am I supposed to say I was a friend of Jameis?" Paul wondered. "Do they expect me to take something from that pile?"
He saw faces turn toward him, turn away.
"They do expect it."
Another man across from Paul arose, went to the pack, and removed the paracompass.
"I was a friend of Jameis," he said. "When the patrol caught us at Bight of the Cliff, and I was wounded, Jameis drew them off so the wounded could be saved."
He returned to his place in the circle. Again the faces turned toward Paul, and he saw the expectancy in them, lowered his eyes. An elbow nudged him, and a voice hissed,
"Would you bring the destruction on us?"
"How can I say I was his friend?" Paul wondered. Another figure arose from the circle opposite Paul, and, as the hooded face came into the light, he recognized his mother. She removed a kerchief from the mound.
"I was a friend of Jameis," she said. "When the spirit of spirits within him saw the needs of truth, that spirit withdrew and spared my son."
She returned to her place. And Paul recalled the scorn in his mother's voice as she had confronted him after the fight.
"How does it feel to be a killer?"
Again he saw the faces turned toward him, felt the anger and fear in the troop. A passage his mother had once film-booked for him on the Cult of the Dead flickered through Paul's mind. He knew what he had to do. Slowly, Paul got to his feet. A sigh passed around the circle. Paul felt the diminishment of his self as he advanced into the center of the circle. It was as though he lost a fragment of himself and sought it here. He bent over the mound of belongings, lifted out the ballast. A string twanged softly as it struck against something in the pile.
"I was a friend of Jameis," Paul whispered.
He felt tears burning his eyes, forced more volume into his voice.
"Jameis taught me that when you kill, you pay for it. I wish I'd known Jameis better."
Blindly, he groped his way back to his place in the circle, sank to the rock floor. A voice hissed,
"He sheds tears."
It was taken up around the ring.
"Usul gives moisture to the dead."
He felt fingers touch his damp cheek, heard the awed whispers. Jessica, hearing the voices, felt the depth of the experience, realized what terrible inhibitions there must be against shedding tears. She focused on the words,
"He gives moisture to the dead."
It was a gift to the shadow world, tears. They would be sacred beyond a doubt. Nothing on this planet had so forcefully hammered into her the ultimate value of water. Not the water sellers, not the dried skins of the natives, not still suits or the rules of water discipline. Here there was a substance more precious than all others. It was life itself, and entwined all around with symbolism and ritual. Water.
"I touched his cheek," someone whispered. "I felt the gift."
At first, the fingers touching his face frightened Paul. He clutched the cold handle of the ballast, feeling the strings bite his palm. Then he saw the faces beyond the groping hands, the eyes wide and wondering. Presently, the hands withdrew. The funeral ceremony resumed. But now there was a subtle space around Paul, a drawing back as the troop honored him by a respectful isolation. The ceremony ended with a low chant.
"Full moon calls thee, Shai Hulud shalt thou see. Red the night, dusky sky, bloody death didst thou die. We prayed to a moon, she is round. Luck with us will then abound. What we seek for shall be found in the land of solid ground."
A bulging sack remained at Stilgar's feet. He crouched, placed his palms against it. Someone came up beside him, crouched at his elbow, and Paul recognized Chani's face in the hood shadow.
"Jameis carried 33 liters and 7 3/32 drachms of the tribe's water," Chani said. "I bless it now in the presence of a Sayadina. Ekari Akairi, this is the water. Philisin Falasi of Paul Muad'Dib, Kivi Akavi, nevertheless, Nakalas, Nakilas, to be measured and counted, Ukair An, by the heartbeats John of our friend Jameis."
In an abrupt and profound silence, Chani turned, stared at Paul. Presently she said,
"Where I am flame, be thou the coals. Where I am dew, be thou the water."
"Bilal Kaifa," intoned the troop.
"To Paul Muad'Dib goes this portion," Chani said. "May he guard it for the tribe, preserving it against careless loss. May he be generous with it in time of need. May he pass it on in his time for the good of the tribe."
"Bilal Kaifa," intoned the troop.
"I must accept that water," Paul thought.
Slowly he arose, made his way to Chani's side. Stilgar stepped back to make room for him, took the ballast gently from his hand.
"Kneel,"
Chani said. Paul knelt. She guided his hands to the water bag, held them against the resilient surface.
"With this water the tribe entrusts thee," she said. "Jameis is gone from it. Take it in peace."
She stood, pulling Paul up with her. Stilgar returned the ballast, extended a small pile of metal rings in one palm. Paul looked at them, seeing the different sizes, the way the light of the glow globe reflected off them. Chani took the largest ring, held it on a finger.
30 liters, she said.
One by one, she took the others, showing each to Paul, counting them.
2 liters. 1 liter. 7 water counters of 1 drachm each. 1 water counter of 3/32 drachms. In all, 33 liters and 7 3/32 drachms.
She held them up on her finger for Paul to see.